Don't frighten us by telling us the facts. 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 We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. We must apply ourselves to our task with same resolution, the same sense of urgency, the same spirit of patriotism and sacrifice as we would show were we at war.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on March 20th, 2017, and produced by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Nate joins me to discuss the 2017 French presidential election and the very dangerous and controversial UN peacekeeping and counterinsurgency mission in Mali. All that is coming up just ahead. Arsenal for Democracy is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Returning to studio this week again after a couple weeks ago is Nate. Hi, Nate.
Great to be back, Bill.
And we're going to be talking first in this hour about the upcoming French presidential elections. And then in the second part of the hour, we're going to be talking about the situation in Mali. That's a topic that we have long covered many times over the years on Arsenal for Democracy through the various stages and phases from 2012 to the conflicts that followed those events. But let's start with France this week. The first round is coming up toward the end of April, in about a month from now. And the French presidential election has a two-round system, so the top two winners from the first round go on to the second, and everyone pretty much shows up to vote and then has to decide between those two contenders. There's five front runners or semi-front runners this time, which is a little unusual. Sometimes there have been three. You know, that's been a relatively common phenomenon in recent years, but five, you know, it's not likely that it's not like all of them have an equal shot, but certainly there are five in relatively close contention with each other for that first round. So we want to talk about some of those candidates, their backgrounds. And then as we're recording this on March 20th, which is Monday, the French presidential debate just happened, and we were watching some of that with dubbing right before we went to record. That had just been airing. And so let's jump into this. Obviously, kind of the headline candidate here, Marine Le Pen, likely going to make it to that second round. Very, very far right candidate, kind of posing, I would argue, as a more acceptable mainstream candidate, like a lot of the European far right has tried to do in recent years. Let's talk about who is she and why is she sort of the bête noire, so to speak, for this election?
Yeah, well, I mean, going back in French politics for many years, you have the National Front, and it's a very far right political organization that for many years had her father, Jean-Marie Le Pen, as its leader. He actually ran and got into the second round in the French 2002 elections. And you had a very interesting situation where large chunks of the French left came out to vote in favor of Jacques Chirac as president, because there was a saying that, you know, even though he's so corrupt, we can't let a fascist like Le Pen into, you know, become president. So there was a saying, vote escroc pas facho, which is just vote for the crook, not the fascist. And, you know, there are articles in New York Times, say, right after the election, sort of casting that as a sort of dominant narrative of that election. But, you know, you have Le Pen, Jean-Marie Le Pen has been sort of pushed aside by his daughter. He's been, you know, extremely controversial, been convicted of minimizing the Holocaust at certain times, saying that the gas chambers were basically a mere detail of World War II.
So it's not surprising that she would want to get rid of him.
Yeah. And so she's sort of in casting herself as sympathetic to the sort of pan-European populist right wing that includes Trump. Obviously, he's been supportive of it. Geert Wilders didn't do as well as he would expect it in the recent election there in the Netherlands, but he's been a part of that. Obviously, Brexit during this debate, Le Pen talked about Trump, talked about Brexit. And so I guess part of this election might hinge on whether those are seen as favorable in France. So, I mean, they're certainly been looking at what's been going on in the U.S. and in the U.K.
And I think a lot of people have argued that if this does, in fact, become a referendum on Europe and the European Union, that's very good for her and probably quite bad for the people who are more supportive of maintaining the current systems.
Yeah, and she's been casting herself as a economic nationalist in many ways. So sort of going the, in some ways, the Trump approach of trying to criticize immigrants, demonize Muslims, but at the same time also cast herself as a strong sort of defender of average French people, basically trying to ensure there's going to be more jobs and, you know, make France great again or whatever she wants to do there. But so it was interesting watching this recent debate, which we'll get in more into later. There was actually times where she was agreeing with the far left candidate, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, because they were both wanting to raise disability benefits, for example. That was one point of agreement they had. And so she was in many ways contrasted with a François Fillon, who is the former French prime minister in the Republicans, and also casting herself against Emmanuel Macron, who is a sort of the centrist candidate, what we might view as a type of neoliberal. And so, you know, her economic policies are coming into conflict with sort of the maybe more austerity focused or liberal sort of center of France. And so she's pushing this economic nationalist message that we definitely recognize here in America.
And, you know, I know that in the past it has been argued, and I assume this is correct, but I haven't gone and independently verified it to make sure it's not just like a trope that it gets thrown around. You know, there's a lot of talk in the U.S. about like Trump supposedly having this, you know, working class base, and that's not really that accurate.
Yeah, that's not quite borne out by the data, but that's right. What his message is playing to sometimes.
But Le Pen, at least, does, as I understand it, especially, you know, Front National, whether it's her or her father, tends to play well in the areas where the Communist Party in France used to do pretty well, and then kind of they faded away and there wasn't really a strong, like even the socialists were not particularly left, and they haven't been for many years in France. They've been drifting pretty, you know, pretty far from where they had been. You know, a lot of that is, of course, epitomized by Macron, that centrist candidate who was the socialist minister for finance, I think. And then, you know, is now an independent candidate. But it's troubling because if you don't have that left presence, that genuine left, like worker presence, I guess would be a good way to put it, and you have a post-industrial situation, a deindustrializing climate, then you're going to see, even if it's not, like it's probably not a majority in those areas, which I think is the case too with the, you know, the talk about these Rust Belt, you know, Trump voters, working class Trump voters, they're not even the majority of the Trump voters in those areas. They're just sort of a force multiplier, perhaps, and most of those people probably don't vote. In France, you know, most people do vote, but there's, you know, a pretty high abstention rate. You can go vote a blank ballot, basically. And I would guess that in a lot of those areas, even if like only, you know, say 25% of that district or whatever supports the Front National, they may have previously supported the communists. And although the Front National is offering those anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim things, which is not probably what the communists were pushing. The similarity, as you said, with that guy from the left party, you know, the Mélenchon, the far left candidate, effectively, there is going to be that overlapping agreement of like, we agree on these economic policies, this economic nationalism, and that putting these workers first. And if no one else is offering that in any meaningful way, then that's how you get people who were maybe communist voters voting later, decades later, for the Front National.
Yeah, it's worth noting also that Mélenchon and Le Pen clashed a lot during this recent debate, a lot of times over issues involving secularism and what people can wear in public, whether it's niqabs or burqas or anything like that. There's a controversy over the burkini at the beach. So we can get into that a little bit later. But there's an interesting article in the New York Times, March 19th, basically saying, headline, as French election nears, Le Pen targets voters who her party once repelled, sort of talking about how she's trying to go into places, including traditional National Front strongholds, sort of in the southeastern part of France, along the Riviera there. But also she needs to run up the score in certain areas if she really wants to actually win and become president, and also has to reach out to areas, as you said, where maybe the National Front hasn't been as strong in previous areas. So, you know, there's places where she has an opportunity to definitely gain ground. But the question is, will it be enough, or is it, you know, will other candidates be able to more effectively target those people?
And I think some of this goes to the kind of unusual features of the French electoral system. You know, comparing basically three different elections illustrates this. So you have the presidential elections where, like, as we saw in 2002, you know, the Republican or UMP candidate gets to the second round and the Front National candidate gets to the second round and everyone turns out to vote for the, you know, conservative, mainline conservative guy instead of the far right guy. That's like a preventative check on the Front National, or has been in the past at least. You look at the National Assembly, similar system. In order to win a seat in the Assembly, you have to win a second round election in each district. So that also prevents kind of the FN from you know, actually gaining a lot of power. They have like two seats in the National Assembly. Finally, though, you have the European parliamentary elections, which we've talked about a lot on this show. We had a guest, Etienne, come on to talk about that back in, I think, 2014. And there's a whole huge rundown on arsenalfordemocracy.com. If you look up about the European parliamentary elections that year, it basically breaks down all the different far right and left parties that did well that year. But what we saw was that Front National ends up coming in first and there's no second round. So they, you know, got 25% of the vote and there was no second round. What we're seeing in the polling again for this is that, you know, she's getting about 25% roughly support. That means that she may actually come in first in the first round, which is not true of her father in 2002. But the question is, does that second round safeguard actually kick in again? Or is she going to, depending on who she ends up against, probably matters as well. Is she going to suddenly pull in the way Trump did all these, you know, mainstream Republican voters? You know, here it would be the Romney voters, essentially converting those mainstream Republican Romney voters to, you know, Trump voters on the basis of, well, it's a conservative, I agree on the social policies, and, you know, I don't think that the extreme stuff is going to be that extreme, and I don't really care as long as my taxes are kept low. You know, if you're like a business conservative, you're probably going to vote for someone like Macron or Fillon. But if you're just I want my taxes low and I also don't care that much about immigrant rights and things like that, you're going to probably consider Marine Le Pen in a way that you would not have considered her essentially flat out neo-Nazi dad.
Right. And I guess the challenge for people looking to oppose Le Pen and try to defeat her, whether, you know, she's probably going to be in the runoff, so beat her in the runoff, is try to find a way to unify people from across the political spectrum, whether it's sort of moderate business conservatives or people that aren't super far left, but they also do not want the sort of National Front fascist to be running the country, and then try to find a way to mobilize around some sort of movement. One person we haven't talked about yet is Benoît Hamon, who is sort of he's the socialist candidate, beat out, I guess, the favored candidate in the primary, Manuel Valls, who is the current prime minister or has been prime minister under François Hollande.
Yeah, he was the most recent prime minister.
Right. And so Hamon has been compared to people like Bernie Sanders, people like Jeremy Corbyn. He's running on a universal basic income platform. So he's been sort of introducing, I guess, some new ideas that was going on during the debate. He was challenging Emmanuel Macron over the sources of his finance. Macron had basically he's been pushing this movement En Marche, basically trying to, in some ways, it's, you know, he's been drawing a lot of crowds. He's talking about how he's getting a lot of individual donations, but Hamon was saying, okay, maybe you're getting donations, but are they from pharmaceutical executives, oil executives, things like that? Because there's now as Macron over the past couple months has risen to prominence as sort of an independent, he's now up there in the polls with Le Pen, both at around 26%. And so now people are thinking that he could be in the next round against Le Pen. So the question is whether the left will come out for him or whether there'll continue to be sort of these clashes between the left and him, because he's really positioned himself quite at the center. He actually caught some criticism during the debate from Fillon, basically saying, oh, a little bit from the right, a little bit from the left. Like, that's who Macron is. So there's already this perception about him, and he's being covered a lot in the media. So, you know, you sort of wonder, will people start turning against that because he's been, you know, so overexposed? He's a former Rothschild banker. That's already been, there's been some dog whistles been going on about that coming from the National Front side. And actually, I think there was also even a cartoon sent out by someone associated with Fillon, sort of a questionable, possibly anti-Semitic sort of diagram or cartoon, basically claiming that Macron is being run by the Rothschilds, even, and also, you know, he's not Jewish, but this is sort of now in the atmosphere there.
And in terms of additional context here, the incumbent socialist president, François Hollande, is not running for re-election because he's very, very, very unpopular. I've certainly been very harshly critical of him, you know, especially on the foreign policy side, which has not actually come up that much. I mean, there's been some, you know, discussion of religion and immigration, but in there hasn't, as far as I know, been a huge reckoning with the fact that terrorist attacks have been pretty directly correlated with the Hollande policy in the Middle East and West Africa. So there have been instances where Hollande ordered special forces troops to be stationed in Burkina Faso. There had not been an attack there pretty much ever, to my knowledge. And then all of a sudden there's this, you know, Al-Qaeda style or ISIS style attack that happens there. Similarly, you know, he was very interventionist in Mali, which we'll be talking about in the next part of the show. He, you know, was involved in the bombing campaigns, the Allied bombing campaigns in Iraq against ISIS. A lot of these things, usually you could draw a pretty direct line between, okay, he did this policy here and there was this backlash that happened that, you know, directly correlates to whichever country they were stationed in. There have been a lot of like pretty serious war crimes committed too by some of these French troops in various places, which is, you know, certainly like it's not like they're innocent troops that are being maliciously attacked out of the blue for their peacekeeping or whatever. There have been some very, very serious scandals that have happened under his presidency. But again, that hasn't really come up. You know, but there's been all these terrorist attacks. That doesn't help his popularity. And then the big problem here is the economic policies, right? He's really torn between, well, on the one hand, I can't make too many reforms because it'll generate huge public backlash. On the other hand, you know, the Germans really want this and the EU really wants this. And I've got this, you know, these neoliberal pressures within France that want these reforms. And there are things that do need to be reformed about France. But there's a tension on like which ones are legitimate versus not. Macron is positioning himself as essentially the like continuation of those policies because they were his policies. He was the finance minister for a while. And that's, I feel like that's not going to play well in the second round against Le Pen if Macron is indeed the one there, because he's basically the status quo economic candidate and Le Pen is the economic nationalist populist candidate. And that, of course, is where kind of Amon tried to come in and say, look, we need to take the Socialist Party in a whole different direction. It's not working. He's not gaining the traction that he needs, partly because there's another left-wing candidate in the race.
Right. And so Hamon has been talking a lot about going against lobbyists, going against corporate money in French politics. So that's sort of the angle he's been taking. Also want to say about Macron, I mean, there's been a couple instances. So there's recently he talked about how the colonization of Algeria was a crime against humanity and was faced down by angry Pieds Noirs, people who are the descendants of French who were living in Algeria.
The colonialist. Yeah.
So, you know, that could be a potential point of division. A lot of Pieds Noirs support the Front National. And so
I think wasn't Jean-Marie Le Pen, her father, was, I think, affiliated pretty closely with it. I don't know if he was himself.
He might have tortured some people in Algeria.
Yes, he was involved in some of the really shady stuff that happened in Algeria, especially after the French state turned to support the independence movement and opposed the colonials. That didn't go over well with some people.
Yeah. Another issue for Macron, and I mean, you know, you can read this in coverage of his in the, say, The Economist, which is probably much more inclined to be supportive of a candidate like Macron. But there's a worry that he may not be able to sort of define himself or define his platform, or it's sort of too wishy-washy. Because, you know, you can see it during the debate. He's sort of struggling, and he didn't do terrible during the debate, but he's sort of struggling to place himself as having sort of more concrete ideas, but in a way that's still outside of the political establishment. He talks a lot about how people are sick of the sort of the established parties, and that we're going to come through in a sort of independent movement and bring people together. And in some ways, I'd almost compare him as like the French Obama going back to 08, where he's sort of coming in with an idea of sort of national unity, but also being anti-establishment, but that's still kind of vacuous. You're not quite sure where it's going to go and, you know, how exactly this could all turn out. So that's sort of one thing I think we need to look at. So
yeah, and Jonathan Cohn, a regular co-host on the show, has tweeted his comment about a month ago, which was, Macron, a socially liberal banker who hates unions, is the ideal candidate of editorial boards everywhere.
Yeah, he also loves Uber, I think, and wants to, he says he's a Nordic liberal, so that's sort of the direction to indicate there. And one thing that came up during this debate pretty significantly was the issue of the work week in France, the 35-hour work week. Macron has talked about how he wants to liberalize labor laws and wants to work out some sort of compromise where the 35-hour work week could be adjusted depending on various corporations making that decision by themselves, or depending on the size. So he's sort of not outright against the 35-hour work week, but also wants to modify it. So he's trying to split the difference there on that. You also had Mélenchon talking about how he wants job guarantees, basically, whereas, as I said, Hamon is pro-universal basic income. And Le Pen, a lot of the time, talks about we need to get people back to work. We need to protect, you know, French jobs, French agriculture, you know, French industry. So that's very much where she's sort of focusing on.
My other huge concern with Le Pen is that even if she doesn't win, you know, obviously she's ratcheted up a lot of pretty hateful rhetoric in this race.
Yeah.
But, you know, you were alluding earlier to how Geert Wilders in the Netherlands did not do as well as expected. But the sort of subheadline there that has not been discussed that much in U.S. media is that a lot of times the parties that win against the far right parties, you know, that when it's looking kind of dicey and they end up winning, they incorporate a lot of the ideas into their platforms. I mean, that's definitely been true in like Sweden with the, you know, the center right, I think, tended to take on, you know, things from the far right parties. Denmark, that's absolutely the case. You had, you know, the Danish People's Party, which is sort of the front runner of all of these far right movements across Europe. They kind of got in early on this. They combine this xenophobia with this economic nationalism and helping the workers and improving the social welfare state. They merge all this together. And then what the other parties take away from this in order to keep them out of power or somewhat out of power is, and that's true for the center left and center right, is they just adopt the nasty elements like the anti-immigrant stuff instead of adopting the, you know, the obvious stuff like, oh, people want a good social welfare state, or they want to take advantage of the fact that productivity has improved and we can, you know, make people's lives easier and that they don't have to work as hard to, you know, to make the same amount of money. Instead of taking that and adopting that, they go with, oh, let's be more xenophobic, which is absolutely what the party did that, you know, has been reelected in the Netherlands. In order to, you know, beat the PVV, they just say, we're going to also be almost as conservative. And I think that's manifested in this French race as well, where you have Fillon from the Republicans or Macron from, you know, who's the independent. You have them adopting these, like, basically flat out anti-Muslim comments, you know,
right.
and Islamophobic stuff.
So there was an exchange during the debate where they're talking about the burkini and just all the debate surrounding religious headscarves, or especially for Muslims. Pretty much no one was rolling back bans on headscarves in, say, schools. So that's something in France where, you know, it's that's not even up for debate anymore, the banning of headscarves in schools.
And that's an issue of, it's called laïcité, which basically translates to secularism, but with a way more weighty sort of context to that word in France. And they just say, well, this is how secularism in France works. So if you try to bend it or change it at all, then you're violating fundamental French principles. And of course, that ends up with ridiculous positions where they're trying to police people's bathing suits.
Right. So Macron was also talking. He basically seemed to come out in support of the burkini ban, saying, okay, well, they've got some mayors and they can do what they want, and basically letting them ban the burkini. So you have absurd situations where you have police officers telling women they have to take off their burkinis on the beach. So, you know, that's very French, I guess. And so,
yeah, ordering people to disrobe doesn't seem like a feminist or secularist position, to be honest. But
right. And so you have another situation where he's also attacking Le Pen, sort of, and because he's cast himself as sort of a representative of a sort of 21st century multicultural France, been open to that. And so maybe he's not exactly on the substance attacking that, but he's verbally sparring with Le Pen's. Basically, at one point he was talking about saying, you want to divide society, turn all Muslims into enemies. Le Pen shot back, like, you're allowing Islamic fundamentalists to take over. Melon Champ came in basically saying, we can't establish clothing police in the streets. Are you going to police whether someone has green hair or he came up with a bunch of other examples. But basically then conceded, oh, but you can in school because it's school and somehow that's different. So you can see there's not a lot of debate on some of these issues, where it would be very strange in the U.S. where that wouldn't be up for debate.
Last thing before we close out this segment that I think we need to get to here. This race has been filled with scandals. I mean, even though they got Hollande not to run for re-election, you know, and he probably would have been one of the most scandal-tard, it's been filled with scandals. But interestingly, not the level of scandals that we saw in, say, the 2007 election, where Sarkozy was elected allegedly using money from Gaddafi in Libya, who he then subsequently bombed and killed. He didn't personally kill him, but right. Scandals, though, this year. Right. What are some of these? I mean, Fillon was supposed to be the major, you know, Republican candidate here. And just his campaign has collapsed, but he refused to drop out, and now it's too late to drop out.
Yeah.
What happened there?
So there's been a corruption scandal involving him, I guess, paying some of his relatives. And I think at one point during the debate, Melon Champ was going on about how he's anti-corruption. He won't be apologized for being against corruption. We can't let people be paying their relatives for jobs. And the camera like cuts to Fillon. He just has this look on his face, like he knows that he's screwed. Like he knows that pretty much, you know, he's been called out and it's going to be really tough for him to make it to the next round. So I thought that was telling. I think there have been a couple scandals involving Le Pen as well. So that's a possibility that could hurt her going forward. French politics is very odd in the sense that sex scandals don't really seem to matter, or they sometimes even boost a person's popularity. I think actually Hollande's popularity ticked up a little bit after he was caught having an affair.
Yeah, I think what he got elected, or let's see, he had, at some point he split up from Ségolène Royal, who had been a previous nominee. And then, like, she's in the cabinet, split up with her, and got together with someone else. And then he also cheated on that person or had an affair with someone. Like, so, yeah, like you said, it doesn't seem to have that much impact. Like, that's probably not the factor there. But Macron has this weird, like, Newt Gingrich-level scandal, except maybe even worse.
Well, I mean, I don't think he's done anything as bad as Newt Gingrich.
No. The fact that he married his teacher.
Well, that did happen.
Newt Gingrich's first wife was his teacher.
Okay, well, it's been a while. So, there's been rumors going against him, claims of Russian-backed fake news targeting him, people saying that he's gay and he's denied that. But there's the situation, where he married his teacher, who's might have been like more than a dozen years older than him, I think.
Yeah, she was not close in age to him.
And
when
he was only
married,
like 16 or so when this all went down. So it's kind of an interesting situation.
Bad.
Yeah, Macron himself, you know, he's a piano player. He wrote a book called Revolution. You know, he's trying to really put himself out there as just this sort of, as I said, maybe similar to Obama, you know, very young. He's only 39, looking for a way to sort of rise above the political parties and build a new movement. And we sort of saw how that went with Obama, maybe not so well.
Yeah, but I mean, it's going to be interesting no matter who wins this election. It's going to be interesting to see who can actually get a majority in the National Assembly to do stuff there. The French presidency is very powerful, so there's a lot you can do without that. But, you know, Front National, like we said, they have two seats right now. Hard to see how they're going to get all the stuff they want to get done without that. You know, they would need Republicans backing them, for example. Similarly, he's obviously going to need to get socialists backing him. I think the other interesting thing about this race has also just been that, you know, Aman and Mélenchon could not come to an agreement on, you know, unifying together and having one of them drop out. That would have helped a lot because their combined polling numbers are, I think, even ahead of Le Pen, or at least very close to it. But the kind of the dilemma there is that Mélenchon got in earlier and was polling ahead of Aman, and therefore he felt, well, I shouldn't have to drop out because I'm polling ahead. But if you think about it, Aman has theoretically at least, has the backing of the Socialist Party structure, which, you know, not the elites may not agree with him. They may not have wanted him as their nominee. They may not like him, but that comes with a certain level of party infrastructure that could have been very helpful, you know, for winning a presidential election. And Mélenchon certainly doesn't have that. But unfortunately, they could not come to any agreement for one of them to drop out. And therefore, you just have these two left candidates that are probably going to finish either last or pretty close to last, with maybe Fillon finishing behind them because of his whole meltdown. And that's just kind of a disappointing situation, I think. Although I, you know, there, part of me wonders if, you know, if Aman got to the second round against Le Pen, would there be a lot of, you know, self-styled moderates and centrists and regular conservatives who would vote for Le Pen over a sort of left-wing socialist candidate? I think that's a very real question, but that we're probably not going to have any way to know. All right, why don't we stop the discussion here on that? We'll be right back after a break to talk about the situation in Mali, which again does have a lot to do with the affairs in France. So Arsenal for Democracy will be right back in just a moment from WVUD and arsenalfordemocracy.com. Democracy. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill. Still in studio with me is Nate. We've been talking so far this hour about the French presidential election. We're going to pivot now to a tried and true Arsenal for Democracy topic on Mali. There's a lot of great stuff at arsenalfordemocracy.com about past developments, kind of explaining some of those. And there are interviews that I've done in the past on the radio show, which, if they're not available on the website, because some of the older episodes are not available on the website, you can subscribe to the show, either get your RSS feed or get your subscription in iTunes or whatever. And if you subscribe to the show, you should be able to go back to 2012 and 2013 and pull some of those episodes where we go into some really deep dives into kind of the background there and how a lot of that played out. But as Nate's going to talk about over the next several minutes, a lot of this does stem from some of that French political action in Africa that we talked about earlier in the show. The 2011 operations in Libya that were part of that NATO operation, the subsequent French intervention in Mali on the ground. We'll talk a little bit about that in response to, you know, a perceived growing takeover risk by Islamist insurgents in Mali. And then also subsequently, we mentioned about some of the recent terrorist attacks in various West African countries that are directly correlated with French military presence. So that's sort of like the general overview, and we should get into that a little bit. You know, a lot of this really kind of gets kicked off by a military coup, a very short-sighted, not very successful military coup that happened in 2012 in Mali, and that was eventually sort of reversed with a lot of international pressure. But the big factor that, you know, ends up causing the reversal is basically that they did not think very carefully through about what happened if the entire military left the security roles and tried to take power right as all these mercenaries were coming home from Libya due to the collapse of the Gaddafi regime. So walk us through that a little bit. What happens in 2011, 2012, 2013 that gets us to the sort of ongoing chronic situation we have now?
Right. I mean, so you have a situation where there's a breakaway effort, largely, I guess, there's ethnic Tuaregs in the region who want to split off, create a state called Azam. So there's the Movement for the Liberation of Azam, or National Movement. And so northern Mali, sort of the Sahel region, you know, slightly below the actual Sahara, but still very arid, dry area. There's ethnic militias break away. And then at a certain point, it was co-opted or taken over by elements within, whether it's Al-Qaeda in Islamic Maghreb or other Islamist militias who want to come down and, you know, get involved in that. And that triggered in 2013 French intervention Operation Serval, because they had taken over Timbuktu. They were destroying, I guess, some ancient Sufi shrines. And there was...
they were marching south pretty fast. Yeah. It looked like at one point that they were possibly going to take over all of Mali.
Yeah, so the French came in, Operation Serval, and over the past couple of years, pushed them back sort of towards the much farther in the north, bleeding into other states as well, including Libya, because there's right. been
this
a lot
all,
of unstable...
These are all around, you know, Libya, Niger... Algeria. These are all countries with sort of affected interlocking situations.
And so there's also what's going on now is you have a UN peacekeeping force in Mali called MINUSMA, and it is the most dangerous UN peacekeeping mission. Over 100 fatalities of UN peacekeepers there already. There have been multiple suicide bomb attacks, or IEDs, mortars, all sorts of things. There was a recent Chinese peacekeeper who was killed, you know, really sad story, guy from central Providence, Henan Providence, poor farmers, and, you know, his girlfriend doesn't get a text back from him, sees that there was a mortar attack on the Chinese peacekeeping base. So, you know, that's just a human casualty there. And there was a recent attack that was extremely deadly in Gao. 77 people were killed, where there was a group of people who I guess had previously participated in the rebel groups, the MNLA, but they were being reintegrated back into Mali. There's been an effort now to try to build a new Mali where these concerns were taken into account, so there wouldn't be any more breakaway movements. But there's been terrorist attacks against those forces. They were trying to go out on patrol with the UN forces, and there was a massive car bomb there. And I think it's worth noting that this car bomb attack has been claimed by a group called Al-Maribatoun, I guess, and led by a guy named Mokhtar Belmokhtar, associated with Al-Qaeda and Islamic Maghreb, I guess has split it with them at times. And Belmokhtar has actually been targeted by the United States in a drone attack in Libya back a couple years ago. So you can see that this is stretching all across the region. There's been a attack at a gas plant in Algeria. There was an attack at some hotels in Burkina Faso, killed 28. And there was an attack in the Ivory Coast where people were gunned down on the beach. So 16 were killed there, including there were also some hostages taken at Bamako in Mali, killed 19. So this is, you know, we're seeing a pretty serious, whether it's insurgency or just various types of terrorist attacks around the region. And that's pushed the UN more into a situation where they're engaging in counterinsurgency. And that sparked a debate whether the UN should really be engaging in these kind of operations, or are they not really suited for that and should just stick to peacekeeping. So that's, I think, a debate we'll see going forward.
And I think that a lot of the sort of precursor to the discussion about the UN's role in Mali was surrounding stuff going on in the Congo, in Democratic Republic of the Congo, and they decided to start taking on more kind of counter-insurgency, counter-rebellion kind of operations. But there was I would argue, a much lower level of sophistication from some of those rebels, whereas, as we've talked about previously on the show, you know, I've interviewed, in fact, experts on the issue of aid workers getting kidnapped or killed in various countries. That happens a lot in Mali and all of the countries nearby, because Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb makes enormous amounts of money off of ransom demands for these people that they kidnap. And that's, you know, you can be a low-level warlord in Congo, you know, selling access to rare earth minerals and make some amount of money to buy Kalashnikovs, or you can be making tens of millions of dollars a year, kidnapping and ransoming people in West Africa and the Sahel region through AQIM. And that's just a whole other level of operation, which again allows them to have these like mortar and rocket attacks that would be a lot more unusual in other countries like Congo, where there are, you know, these UN missions and more aggressive UN missions. But, you know, there's also the kind of the ongoing debate based because of what's happening in other countries. We alluded to this earlier in the episode, but like Central African Republic, France was staging a lot of military activities there as well, around the same time as the Mali stuff. But you had French peacekeeping troops who were part of the UN operations who were sexually abusing children.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's very bad and does not help with, you know, deterring attacks on these missions. And it raises a lot of questions, too, I think, about what the French have actually accomplished in any of these countries that they've been in. But they seemed very intent on saying, like, well, we can't allow them to take over an entire country. I mean, it sort of would have been, I think it would have been ISIS before ISIS. That's my best guess. I mean, it would be a little bit more difficult because Mali is not predominantly Arab. And I think that ISIS has a very clear, like, racial hierarchy within their organization, you know, that the Chinese Muslims are the most expendable, and then you bring in the Russians, you know, and the various Caucasus states, and they would have a lot of trouble, I think, trying to establish something comparable to ISIS in a place like Mali, where it would be, you know, basically black majority in a lot of the parts of the country, at least. But, you know, there's also these areas in the north with these other ethnic populations, and they, you know, exploiting these kind of ethnic factions would be a strong suit of an ISIS type organization.
Yeah, I was watching this interesting video of young girls and women who, you know, just had recently been liberated from the rule of Al-Qaeda in Islamic Maghreb. And they were talking about how, you know, they're very glad they don't have to wear the veils anymore, and they can go talk to the boys and their other friends. And of course, I guess there's a saying in Mali that it's 98% Muslim, 2% Christian, but 100% animist, meaning that they have retained a lot of the traditional beliefs that, you know, they've always had before Islam had spread to the region. And also that a lot of them are Sufi, the Muslims there, that, you know, very different than the kind of Wahhabism or other ideologies that are, you know, spread by Al-Qaeda aligned groups. So, you know, you can see the happiness on their face, where it's, you know, they're probably still Muslim, but at the same time, it's a very different interpretation, obviously. So pivoting back to the UN as well, I think it's important to note that they've stepped up their use of drones to surveil and provide, you know, sort of real-time information about sort of these vast expanses of desert and be able to track people there. They're also, and it's interesting, they're using at times green helicopters rather than non sort of white helicopter to signify that they're UN. So they're in many ways clearly engaging in some sort of counterinsurgency, or they're involved in that. And that's potentially going to be a trial. People have spoken to this like, okay, we're doing this in Mali, so we know what to do if we ever have to go in Syria or some other place like that where, you know, there's a situation where we could be under attack constantly. It's also worth noting that the Germans have also stepped up their commitment. They're sending drones. They're sending more troops and various helicopters and things. So Germany's getting involved as well. And yeah, this is sort of going to be a challenge for the UN going forward, because they are facing, you know, pretty sustained, serious attacks. And at the same time, if they're so heavily engaged in a form of counterinsurgency, which we should step back and say is a pretty problematic concept that has been extremely, in many ways, ineffective in many times it's been tried. But just thinking that they might have to engage in some of that, will they be viewed as not an impartial force, peacekeeping force, but rather just a tool for whatever various, you know, neo-imperialist or colonial interests that people could perceive? So they need to have a reputation for even-handedness. As you mentioned, what was going on in Central African Republic, that further undercuts it. So this is a pretty dangerous situation for everyone involved.
And I think, you know, Hollande especially, the outgoing French president, tried to pitch the French military activities in Africa as being like the new France, and that we're going to learn from the mistakes of the past and not repeat those. But when you have these abuse crises in Central African Republic, when you have these allegations, which, you know, who knows, they're Human Rights Watch, so sometimes there's questions there about accuracy, but allegedly, you know, watching as Christian militias were butchering people, you know, Muslim people in front of them, or at least desecrating corpses in front of them and not really intervening. That harkens,
not even taking the headphones out.
It harkens back to Rwanda, you know, in 1994, where after the genocide was effectively ended by the Tutsi militia that came to power, the Hutus who had committed the genocide fled the country, and the French arrived very late to the situation as quote unquote peacekeepers and essentially protected the retreating genocidal force. And then, of course, allowing them across into Congo ends up triggering the First and Second Congo Wars, which leads us back to what we were talking about earlier. So the problem with this is that even when they have a short-term success like they did in 2013, I mean, that's a, you know, it's a flash military operation, tactically achieved its goals. The question is, what is the lasting effect? Did it accomplish anything really? And obviously, as you said, there's these examples of these, you know, young people that are being essentially liberated and from this restrictive, you know, terrorist-run regime that they don't support, that's very socially conservative, and that matters to them. But did the French operations really solve the problems in any of these countries? And certainly in Mali, it's unclear. And as you said, they're using these UN operations now as kind of like a testing ground or a way to come up with potential strategies for the future. I'm guessing, like, for example, if you ended up deploying the UN in Afghanistan to completely replace US forces, that would be a very, very volatile, high risk situation. And, you know, as you said, it gets into some neutrality questions there. But on the other hand, you have these operations in like South Sudan, where they just don't do anything. And it's like the old style, like in Rwanda, where you're basically ordered to just stand there. I mean, you had situations toward the end of 2013, I recall, where tens of thousands of people were, you know, fleeing, you know, ahead of advancing, you know, armed forces in South Sudan and fleeing onto these UN bases, which had like two armed guards or something like that, you know, and or certainly it was lightly defended. And the question is, well, is your job as a peacekeeper to defend like 25,000 refugees that suddenly show up at your base, you know, and are you actually armed to be able to do that? But the more you're giving them guns, it's creating this moral hazard where they end up getting attacked as well. And I don't think we have an answer on this. Like, I don't think we have a clear position on this either, because it's like, it's a difficult question. There's the pros and cons on both sides, but I think we can certainly say that the French military activities in the past five or so years in Africa have, well, longer than that at this point, have been a pretty big disaster, and have certainly at minimum not been a break from the past mistakes that they said they were not going to repeat again.
Yeah, and I mean, you can go back farther than that. You can go back a couple decades, a couple centuries, in especially when we're talking about that part of Africa, and obviously French Empire stretching through there. So I guess now we're in a situation where you just have to hope that between French operations, between the UN peacekeepers, and between the Malian government, people can continue to train those groups that were involved in the breakaway efforts to try to bring them back within Malian society, and, you know, have a shared prosperity towards the future where people aren't trying to break away and there aren't the dangers of these Al-Qaeda-linked militias seizing the capital. So that's a situation where, you know, it's probably going to be really tough in the next couple of years continuing forward. Probably more people will be killed, but this is just something we're going to have to continue to pay attention to, and just because of all the problems. So.
And in general, you know, most of these separatist type organizations don't generally share the extreme views of Al-Qaeda or ISIS. That tends to be an easy way to organize a lot of these insurgencies, or come up with some novel way of pushing forward, or they're just simply exploiting an existing, you know, conflict situation. Also doesn't really help that Saudi Arabia is dumping enormous amounts of money into very, very strict, and not only strict, Sunni Islam in West Africa, but actively hostile versions of Islam that, like, oppose other, you know, they certainly don't like animists, right? And they don't like Sufis, and they don't like Shia. And that's been a huge issue in Nigeria lately, where you get Saudi money basically coming in directly like, oh yeah, you should be anti-Sufi or anti-Shia. And these are divisions that everyone's been getting along. Why are you now, like, creating a brand new division? Not great. All right. Well, Nate, that's going to do it for us today. Thank you so much for being here to talk about the French presidential election and the situation in Mali with the UN.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD, WVUD HD1, and WVUD HD2 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. You can get additional commentary at ArsenalForDemocracy.com daily, as well as links to articles discussed today. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.